welcome back to Mother Tongue, your extra set of eyes, ears and finger on the pulse for all parents around the world. I'm Marianne.
And I'm Sarah. We are your co-hosts. We catch up weekly, chatting with experts, people of interest and mamas from around the world to discuss everything relating to parenthood.
Listen in to hear more on navigating mamahood, the products we swear by and the experiences we've been through during pregnancy, motherhood, work and beyond.
Let's get going, shall we?
So you're going to have to start by telling me about the weather.
I mean, it even made national news. It was that bad.
I mean, when you say national, do you mean international?
International
news. International news.
International news. And they even shut Dubai Airport for a while.
I can't believe that.
No check-ins today.
No, I know. So someone actually, one of my colleagues, was stuck in her car from 4 p.m. yesterday afternoon till 11 a.m. today. She said that they'd shut all check-ins. They're still doing connecting flights, but they'd stopped all check-ins yesterday afternoon through to this morning. And actually, when we landed this morning into DXB Airport, there were no taxis and there were just people in the arrivals hall.
Awful.
Awful. And bless, oh my God, we were on the flight. So our flight was 3 hours delayed, yet they did that really annoying thing where they were like, oh, you still need to be at the airport on time because
we like to make you wait longer.
Yeah. So they were like, you have to be at the airport on time. You have to check in on time. So we were there, let's say we got to the airport at 1:00. Our flight took off at 5:00 and then it landed late. So I think we landed at 3:30. By the time we got through passport control and the bags had come, they also put us on a stand, which in a big Emirates plane, I haven't ever been on a stand before. Mm. Took them ages for the stairs to come to the stand and then ages for the buses to drive around. So yeah, we finally got our bags and luckily we'd got someone to drive Adam's car to the airport and we managed to get home in Adam's car. He's got a massive car, but there was this mum that we met on the plane. She was flying by herself with two children, one who must have been, I would say, 9 months, and then the other was 3.
Oh, wow.
The 3-year-old did not sleep. So we were 3 hours delayed taking off. We were then 7 hours in the air. We then landed. She was like, I'm going to meet my husband on holiday. He's been out here on business. And then I'm going on holiday, staying at the Atlantis. I was like, fuck, how the fuck are you going to get there? And then I realized that there's no taxi. So like, I really pray that her husband came to get her, because otherwise she would have been left in DXB Airport overnight.
With the two kids.
With two kids and one that hadn't slept. Wow. A 3-year-old. And honestly, by 3, I thought they were quite good at traveling. I mean, Rafa was a total Gordon, so just like linked into the TV and just wouldn't move. Mm. But oh, it just makes me feel that Isla's going to be horrendous for another couple of years.
Yeah. I'm really worried. I'm worried about Blake when we next fly, because she won't nap if she's not in her cot and she won't sit still and you can't reason with her yet.
No.
At 18 months. But honestly, the weather, they did lots of weather warnings and I was kind of a bit blasé about it because last time they said it would be really bad and it wasn't.
Yeah.
But in terms of the rain, so in UAE, in a year, we normally get 80 millimeters of rain. We had 245, 3 years worth of average rainfall in Dubai in 12 hours.
That's wild.
And they said it's the equivalent of it raining in London for 5 months. 5 months of rain.
That's ridiculous. That's absolutely
in a country
ridiculous.
With no drain.
No drainage. And actually saying that, then I feel like what I've seen so far is like they've done quite well to clear lots of it.
The cleanup is insane. Like the amount of trees, and I mean like huge palm trees and massive trees that were across the roads blocking, hailstones, everything you can think of. That lightning that isn't just like fork lightning, but nonstop strobe lighting. The amount they've already cleared up is incredible.
I saw so many people's stories yesterday as we were waiting to board the plane, which by the way was fucking terrifying, not knowing what we were flying into. I was like, oh my God, or not knowing if we were going to get home.
I'm impressed you got home. I really am.
To be fair, so am I. That's why when we got into bed at 5 a.m. and Isla had barely slept, I was like, it's fine. We're home. We made it. But the sky was green at points.
Yes, it was green.
What the fuck? Why? How? What was it, by the way? Because it was a cyclone, right? Or a typhoon?
I think it was called something even different to those two, but it was this...
It was a weather thing, though. It wasn't them cloud seeding.
No, it was wasn't. Like it was some... a proper storm that came and it did genuinely turn the sky green.
Where's it gone now?
I mean, I'm hoping it's all rained out now and...
Because it came from Oman, right?
Yeah.
Fucking hell, just terrifying.
But I hope that's the end of it for this year because that's the third big storm we've had.
We keep saying this. I mean, I said this when we left. I was like, oh, no, we're done now. After the last one, I was like, oh, we're done now. No. But saying that, I mean, I looked at my weather app today and we're due like
showers.
Another 10 days of nice, cool weather.
Oh, okay, good.
So like, I feel like we're now mid-April and the weather is nice.
Strangely nice. And to top off that we had... Obviously, weeks and weeks of finishing early at school.
Ramadan hours.
2 weeks of Easter, a full week off for Eid. They went back for 1 day.
I know.
1 day. I know. School's closed the rest of the week.
I know. Awful.
It'll be summer holidays soon.
It will be summer holidays soon. And now I'll have to travel with my children again, which is really not an appetizing thought, to be fair. Oh, anyway, but yeah, I mean, I guess there's lots of things to be grateful for. At least our houses are intact. So many exactly. Poor people I saw on Instagram had like ceilings fall in, like total flooded furniture ruined. We, touch wood, have been really lucky. Yeah. Like the fact that we got to come home to a house that was relatively normal was like a massive saving grace. So very grateful for that. But hopefully here on out, we've got lovely weather ahead of us. I was actually really looking forward to coming back because we've just spent a week in the UK, or just over a week in the UK, and it was Baltic. Freezing, absolutely freezing. I mean, I was not prepared for the weather. You know, when you're just like so cold that your bones hurt. I mean, obviously it was not that cold. Everyone in England listening to this be like, oh, fucking get a grip. But for me, it was cold. For the kids, it was cold. But it was quite nice. Like weirdly, April's quite a nice time to go back because I feel like everyone's just a little...
A bit chirpier that the good weather's coming.
But also just, it's not manic because I feel like when you go back at Christmas, everyone's busy. There's parties, people are traveling. Like it's all just a bit chaotic. And then when you go back in the summer, it's the same. Loads of people are away. Loads of people have like lots of fun plans. There's lots of things happening. Whereas this was just, you know, just going over to see people have a cup of tea and
nice.
Kids just like roll around in the garden in their coats, like quite nice, just relax. So I didn't feel quite as manic. But yeah, no, I am glad to be back. I feel like in terms of like work, I'm like, it's already the middle of April and I feel like we barely got started on our April work within the agency. So yeah, lots of things to work on, but I kind of feel like I'm ready. I feel like if I get a good night's sleep tonight and manage to tackle the jet lag, tomorrow will be a better day. I need to try and get in the gym tomorrow.
If it's open, still shut today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've checked twice.
I actually bet they had terrible damage. Will you go tomorrow?
Yes.
Maybe I'll come with you.
I didn't go yesterday and then they closed it and then it's been closed all day today. You know, the staff at Spinney's slept in Spinney's overnight.
That makes me so sad.
Which is probably a lot safer.
Yeah, true. But still, I mean, anyway, Adam actually went to Spinney's earlier.
I've been twice today.
He said that they're out of supplies.
It's literally like...
He had to buy lactose-free milk for the kids. Obviously, they didn't give a shit. They guzzled that away. I was like, this is wild.
It's like COVID times.
But worse. Yeah. But it will only be for a day, let's be honest. Tomorrow, there's going to be milk on the shelves and bread.
Yeah.
Baked. You know, it's not the end of the world. I was really excited about some takeout tonight, but I feel like Adam was like, I'm going to make meatballs. I was like,
I'm not sure you'd get the takeout.
No, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. I don't think anyone will get here.
No.
I think we'll be a few days off takeout. But yeah, lots to look forward to. We had a little break last week. To be perfectly honest with you, we actually forgot to record a chat. So we didn't want to put an episode out because I was traveling and Sarah's got family over. And do you know what? I totally like forgot. I've just totally forgot. Unless you remembered and you thought, I'm just not going to tell her.
No, but then we did discuss it and it was like, when are we going to find the time between?
Well, we discussed it on Friday evening when our producer is off all weekend and then I had the memorial on Monday. So yeah. I'm not sure what you were thinking we were going to do, but yeah, wild. Anyway, we're back now. We've got another, God, I think 8 episodes left in the bag of this season.
That's flying.
I know, isn't it just? So stay tuned. Another great episode this week to sink your teeth into. So I think without further ado, Sarah.
Let's get going, shall we?
Today we are speaking to a wonderful woman who has been helping children and their families overcome obstacles and challenges related to learning difficulties, autism, ADHD, challenging behavior and missing developmental milestones for over 20 years. Advocacy and kindness and compassion guide her practice with children, their families, and individuals, with the goal to empower individuals to know their worth and strengths. A co-founder of Thriving Souls, she is here to discuss everything related to ADHD, challenging behavior, and autism. We are so incredibly excited to welcome Carrie Green to Mother Tongue. Carrie, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. How are you guys?
Very good. Thank you. It's actually been a very, very busy Thursday, but you know, we're thriving and excited about Friday. It's a very interesting chat we're having today. Do you know what? We've actually never done anything on the topic of ADHD and ADD. And I think for parents who have kids our age, it's an interesting topic because I feel like, lots of parents kind of get into that age thinking, you know, could they have ADD or ADHD or any form of learning difficulties? So I'm really excited to have this chat and learn more because I, for one, do not know nearly enough about this topic. But before we get into all the good educational stuff, can you please tell our lovely listeners a little bit about yourself?
So I'm Carrie. I'm originally from the States, but I've been in the UAE for the past 9 years. Before that, I was in Ireland for 8 years. So like I'm a true expat. And I own and run Thriving Souls. So I work over the past 20 years, I work with children, mostly with learning difficulties, ADHD, autism. Sometimes there's no diagnosis, but there's just kind of missing milestone gaps, challenging behaviors that aren't typical for that age. I work one-to-one with the kids. I've got a team of therapists that work with me, and I do a lot of parent coaching as well to kind of educate the parents on how to advocate and help their kids.
And I mean, it's quite a niche topic. Was there any particular reason why you took this career path?
A long time ago when I was in university, you know, almost over 20 years ago, I was, you know, in the field of psychology. So I knew I wanted to do something in that area. And I was really guided by, I mean, at the time, my professors and my family, and there was a program at my university specific for kind of the field of applied behavior analysis with, you know, what we now call, you know, neurodevelopmental disorders. So it was, for me, it started with education first, and then I went into the field. And obviously, I fell in love with it over the years. I worked in really amazing places in the States and in Ireland. And, you know, I learned so much from the people that I worked with, and I've worked it with so many different kids and populations and settings and ages and diagnoses and behaviors. And I just have fallen in love with it over and over again throughout the years.
Oh, amazing. So can you tell us, because I honestly don't know enough, what exactly is ADHD?
Right. So ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, right? So I think it's really interesting. Obviously, I can tell you, you know, what psychologists look for, kind of a clinical diagnosis, but it's really interesting to see what I see every day when I go and see kids in schools and when I work with the kids, because it, you know, it's a different portrait than the clinical diagnosis. And so I don't diagnose kids, right? So I come either after or before that. So a psychologist, an educational psychologist, would usually be the one to formally diagnose a child with ADHD, and they do lots and lots of different assessments, right? So it's not just one, it's a whole battery of assessments that they do. And, you know, you'll probably get to this, you know, what is it? So, you know, you could have the combined type where it's hyperactivity, impulsivity, and inattentiveness, or you could be diagnosed with the hyperactivity and the impulsivity, just that, or you could be diagnosed with just the inattentiveness. So the combined one where you kind of have all three is the most common, right? And this is, you know, it's not to say that someone is inattentive with everything. It's really inattentive with things that they don't enjoy, right? Wow. So with kids, you know, when they're in school and in these structured settings, they learn over time, okay, I don't love doing this, but I'm going to do it, right? They just learn, like, those are the rules of school. That's what's expected. And they just get on with it. Kids who possibly have a diagnosis of ADHD, they don't have that mindset. You know, they don't get on with it. They don't like it, so they don't want to do with it. You know, it's difficult for it to hold their attention. Things they really enjoy, they can attend to for an extreme amount of time, right? So it's not that they're inattentive with everything. It's specifically with things that they don't enjoy. So that's kind of, you know, the clinical side of it. Now, I go in and I see kids all the time in schools. My own son, definitely, if I were to get him assessed when he gets a little bit older, I think he'll probably end up with a diagnosis of ADHD because there's certain characteristics that I see. So one is that one day is a really quote unquote good day, right? Meaning the child is kind of doing what's expected.
Can I just quickly ask, how old is your child, just out of curiosity?
He's six.
He's six.
Six and a half. Yeah. Usually a diagnosis might happen 8, 7, 8, 9, maybe 10, maybe a little bit older, but that's kind of typical because, you know, that's when, I mean, maybe a parent was watching it, you know, and could kind of see signs. And, you know, when they think back, they were like, oh yeah, these things I did notice when my child was a little bit younger, but I thought maybe they would grow out of it, you know, and that sort of thing. So it's usually around that age. And I think that's probably because in schools, it gets a little bit harder at that age, right?
Yeah.
Like, it gets a little bit more serious, a little bit more structured, a little bit more academic. It, you know, it comes up with things like that. So I see the same things in my son that I see with kids that I support in schools. So, and even with my own son. So one day's, you know, like I was saying, a quote unquote good day, meaning kind of doing what's expected, you know, even academically, they're sitting down, they're writing 10 sentences, just like the other kids. They're not having behavioral challenges. But then the next day, they're more off task, right? So they're not able to do the same things. They're left with their work. You come back and they haven't done it. And it's really confusing, I think, a lot of times for someone who's, you know, an adult who's in the child's life every day, because they're like, well, yesterday they did it, but today they're not. And so then it can become like a mindset, like the child is choosing not to do it today.
Mm.
And that's where you get kind of the labels of the child's lazy and things like that, right? Which is not, that's not the case at all. So it's things like that. A lot of children with ADHD have difficulties with writing, right?
Yeah.
The mechanics of writing might be slightly delayed, like actual letter formation. But then when they have that down, it's really difficult for them to think about what they want to say and then put that into pencil and paper. It's the whole processing of it because they've got so many thoughts going on at the same time. So that's usually quite difficult. Sometimes there are social issues as well, because that impulsivity might come out. And so they might be quite impulsive, even with friends, with their peers, kind of screaming in somebody's face, you know, things like that, or, you know, having difficulty with turn taking and playing games. And as kids get older, other peers, they get less patient with kids, right? When kids are really little, you know, they're all kind of the same, but then they get less patient. So there could be some social difficulties. A lot of times there could be difficulties in the reading area because it's difficult for them to kind of read something and remember what it said to be able to kind of answer comprehension questions. So there's lots of areas that come up. One thing that I think is quite interesting that I notice in my son and I've seen with kids is this whole concept of time anxiety.
Yeah.
So kids with ADHD, they often experience anxiety specifically around time, right? So they want to know kind of what's happening, what's the routine, what's the structure, even though it might be the same thing every day. So they might come into class and want their teacher to kind of go through, okay, so what's the routine for the day, even though, you know, it's pretty much the same every Tuesday. My own son, I notice he wants to know when something's happening. And, you know, he'll ask about it again and again until I show him concretely on a calendar when something is going to happen. It's really hard for him to visualize without that concrete visual.
Yeah. It's so interesting because, I mean, it's, again, so our kids are young. Our kids are, our eldest are 3.5. At what age can parents start to notice these possible ADHD symptoms?
Yeah, because the diagnosis is a lot older than I would have expected.
Same.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a parent probably doesn't really notice these things until a child is in school. So maybe like 5, 6, but once maybe there is a diagnosis, they could maybe look back on things and see, oh, okay, like these are things that maybe I should have noticed, you know, or I did notice, but I thought it was kind of typical child development, like not being able to follow multiple step instructions, you know, forgetting what they're supposed to do. Emotional regulation is a big thing. And I do want to kind of preface this with most kids cannot properly regulate their emotions until like they're 8 or 9. But I would say average kids can do that before, right? When something disappointing happens, you see as your child gets older and older, even way before 8 or 9 years, they're able to control it and get on with the you know, with being disappointed, but not having, you know, sharp outbursts. Whereas kids with ADHD, it's way more common for them to have these outbursts every single time something happens, right?
Yeah.
So that's something as well that they look back on and think, well, okay, you know, I thought these were just kind of typical of kids, but I could see now that it was a little bit more excessive, you know, than the average. And, you know, I think often, you know, kids with ADHD misread situations, you know, like my own son, for instance, he will even tell me, like, if his friends are playing, he finds it hard to step into that situation, and he'll misread it with them having like a closed group that they don't want him to play, which is not the case at all, right? So a lot of anxiety and just a lot of thoughts. Like, I think it's really kind of strange that, you know, it's this inattentiveness, but I do think there's an overthinking element of it with people with ADHD. I think that they overthink situations as well.
How common is it, can I ask?
Yeah, so with little kids, I think the latest statistics is like 5 to 8% of kids, mostly boys.
Wow, 5 to 8%. Is ADHD something that you then live with your entire life? Or if you get diagnosed as a kid, do you grow out of it as an adult? Or just as an adult, do you get better at managing it?
You get better at managing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, so once you have a diagnosis, the diagnosis wouldn't be taken away, right?
Sure.
But you get better. I mean, there is a lot of ADHD with just natural maturation, right? You mature and you learn how to kind of cope with things and deal with things a little bit later than your peers, but you eventually get there, right? Yeah. You're not going to have meltdowns and have the inability to wait when you're 16 years. So you do get there. It's just a little bit later. And you learn techniques. You learn techniques for when you're feeling a certain way, you take more breaks, or you learn to break your work up so you don't feel too overwhelmed. And as kind of, as you get into young adulthood and adulthood, you have to develop those skills or you'll never be able to get anything done, right? But I do think that kids could be taught all of these skills much earlier, right? Because I've talked with a lot of adults that, you know, have had a diagnosis later in life, and they think back to their childhood and think how difficult it was for them and how confused they were. You know, we can definitely teach these kids at a much younger age what to do with all of these racing emotions, how to break their work up, how to advocate for themselves, really, how to tell people, I am not focused today. Can I break my work up? Can I do less work today? Can I go, you know, take more movement breaks, right?
Yeah.
Instead of sitting there kind of suffering through it and then maybe having some kind of inappropriate behaviors and them getting frustrated and the, you know, the adult, you know, the educator or the parent getting frustrated, because ADHD is very outward. It's outward behaviors, but there's a lot internally that's going on.
Yeah.
That we don't know about. And it, you know, kids are kids and they don't fully understand these emotions and the things going on inside their body. I mean, that takes time, but I think we can help guide them a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, you were saying that a person with ADHD, you know, they think differently, they process things differently. So they often struggle to concentrate because they've got so much going on in their head. They struggle to get things from down on pen and paper. They can struggle in social situations and get quite anxious when routines are changed. So how do we parent differently, and how can we make sure, you know, there's not all these huge outbursts and they're not as anxious? What different things do we need to do once our child has been diagnosed with ADHD?
I mean, I think a lot of it is just being patient, you know, and being really understanding. I mean, more understanding than you've ever been, and very patient with things and using very clear and concise language. Using a lot of visuals helps, because it takes something that's a little bit abstract and makes it very, very concrete. So, you know, if they're struggling to, you know, get themselves ready in the morning or get themselves ready in a timely way, even though you keep telling them and even though it's the routine every day, make a little visual schedule so that they see, it can be text, it can be a picture, it can be both. So they see these are the things that they need to do in order, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe even tie those things to reinforcement, right? So when they, you know, check off that they've done something, once they have all their checks, they get some kind of in reinforcer. Because the thing with positive reinforcement, it's definitely needed. I think it's definitely needed with kids in general, but with a child with ADHD, they need some kind of external motivator, right? I mean, the whole goal in everything that I do is that eventually a child starts to do things because they're internally motivated, right?
Yeah.
But that takes time. Even for kids with no difficulties, it takes time for them to be internally motivated to do things. Mm. And when you have a child who has extra difficulties and extra challenges, it's going to take even more time. So we have to use some external motivation while they're still learning.
Can I ask about the diagnosis? So how important is the diagnosis? If, you know, you've now mentioned that your six-year-old, you're pretty certain he has got ADHD. And so I'm guessing with all your wisdom, you are putting in place ways to support him and help him. What difference would the diagnosis actually make? I mean, do we need to actually get our children tested? Is it essential? Is there medication that needs to be involved? Or is it just essentially supporting them the best you can with their diagnosis or supposed diagnosis?
Yeah. So a diagnosis, especially here in the UAE, I feel like it's a very personal choice by families, right? A lot of families want a diagnosis because I have talked to so many families who blame themselves for their child's behavior and difficulties, and they think it's a parenting flaw or something that they did early on with their child. And so when they do get a diagnosis, it makes them feel better.
Yeah.
It helps them to understand because then they get, okay, it's ADHD. I can do this research. The psychologist has given me all these recommendations. I can educate myself.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I didn't know anything about it before. So I think a lot of parents, it helps. For me, it's not important that he have a diagnosis or not have a diagnosis, right? We might go through the assessment process at some point, but it's not completely necessary. And for schools, some schools require it, but it's not a legal requirement, right? Like in the States, an IEP is a legal document that schools have to provide. To have an IEP, you have to have a diagnosis, right? So a lot of times parents would want that in the States so that they can get the supports that their child needs. Here, it's not legally necessary, right? So even if your child has difficulties, they might get support from the inclusion department, even without a diagnosis, right? They're not going to necessarily require it. So I think, you know, from what I've seen in the UAE, when parents are not giving their child the support that they need and they're struggling in school, a lot of times then schools would kind of guide them towards an assessment and a diagnosis because I think they think that would help the parent to fully understand. But if you're providing all the supports that your child needs and you're working with the school, you know, the actual assessment and the diagnostic process, I think is completely up to you. But I know it does help some parents.
Sure.
Some parents, it doesn't help. Some parents don't want to focus on it. They don't want to focus on that. They just want to help their child.
Yeah. You mentioned there that, you know, parents like the reassurance that they're not the cause of the ADHD. So is ADHD something you're born with, or is it something that can develop through lifestyle? I actually really don't know.
Is it genetic?
There's a lot of things out there that are unknown about ADHD and about a lot of other diagnoses. And it's not completely confirmed that, you know, this is the one true cause, but there's definitely a genetic component, right? There's been tons and tons of studies that it's kind of linked through family members. And it's very common for multiple family members to have ADHD. There's also some research studies to show that a child can be born with a genetic predisposition for ADHD, and then something is triggered. Something triggers that gene in their environment. So it could be trauma. It's been linked to trauma, and it's been linked to environmental toxins, that triggers the gene to then kind of switch on. Had they not encountered that, then it wouldn't have been triggered and they wouldn't show they wouldn't show signs, right? So there's a lot of research that points towards that as well.
And wow. I'm now going to come on to the difference between ADD and ADHD, because again, something that I am clueless on, which is really ignorant of me. Yeah, what is the difference between ADD and ADHD?
Yeah, so ADHD has the hyperactivity. The hyperactivity and the impulsivity kind of component. And ADD is just the inattentiveness. I would say the most common is to have it combined those. So you show elements of all three, right? But obviously there's different assessments and different diagnoses for all of them. So it's with the hyperactivity, impulsivity, or just the inattentiveness. That's the key difference.
So it is basically this, not the same, but they are similar.
Yeah.
Whereas autism is very different to both.
Autism is completely different. It's a different diagnosis. It's a different, I mean, it's completely different, right? So it is a neurodevelopmental disorder, but I mean, there's tons and tons of neurodevelopmental disorders. So autism, ADHD fall under that umbrella, but they're completely different.
Completely different. And I mean, when it comes to ADHD, can it be cured? Is it something that people are working on a cure towards, or is it just something that will be in society forever after?
I feel like it's just part of your personality.
Yeah. I mean, to an extent, I mean, it does seem to be, you know, this is who the person is. And, you know, I mean, I've been working in the field of kind of behavior change, right, for many, 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 many years. And you know, I help to fill milestone gaps and, you know, give a person opportunities to be independent. But a person is who a person is, right? So
yeah.
You can't drastically change someone, and you can't, you know, make them not have a diagnosis anymore, or, you know, make them want to do something that they're not internally motivated for. So I don't think that there's going to be a cure for ADHD. I think it's also just lifestyle changes, things that a person has to adapt for themselves. I mean, there's medication, right? We haven't talked about that. There's medication for ADHD. And in my experience, just in observing kids, like from members of my family, because I've worked with, you know, it can really change a child. So they're not hyperactive anymore, but it really dulls their personality, suppresses their appetite. So, you know, which one would you rather have? And, you know, I think it can work quite differently for adults. Like I've seen, even from family members, I've seen adults who have been on medication where it does help them. So I think maybe as a person gets older, medications could be a little bit more beneficial. But
sure.
I don't know. It seems, in my opinion, it seems a lot for these tiny little bodies, you know?
Definitely. So if we don't want to go down the medication route, how can we help kids with their behavior issues while still keeping them true to who they are?
Yeah. So I think behavioral therapy can help to an extent. I mean, this is what I do. And I'm not here to say that behavioral therapy helps with everything, because I actually don't think it does with ADHD. Something like autism, and I think that, you know, behavioral therapy goes a longer way. I think behavioral therapy is part of the support for ADHD. Also think things like occupational therapy help. I think once a child gets old enough, I think having sessions with a counselor or a psychologist where they can actually talk about things that are going on in their life and how their, you know, the diagnosis is affecting them. Because I do think it's important that a child knows, you know, the difficulties that they face. So I think regularly talking about their feelings and what's going well and what's not going well. But behavioral therapy definitely helps as far as, you know, using visuals to make things more concrete, teaching them specifically, like in a classroom structured school setting, how to think about their emotions and then break their work up. Right. So as a child gets older, learn that, okay, you're not feeling super focused today. The teacher expects you guys to kind of read a passage and then answer 10 questions, but you're not able to do that. You need to go talk to your teacher about it. You need to, and we provide lots of visuals to chunk work up, right? To kind of show them how to do it, to take movement breaks a lot, right? So to get out of there and go do something to get their mind on something else, coping skills when it comes to emotional regulation, you know, so when they're getting anxious, when they're getting upset about things, things to bring them back down to a regulated state. And I think in general, you know, incorporating this into the child's life, into the child's day, so that they learn as they get older to do certain things to keep them in this calm and regulated state, which is hard. I mean, you know, we're all talking about all of that right now. And I think it's really difficult to do that with little kids. Okay, let's sit down and, you know, learn to do breath work. But as a child gets older and they get into adolescence, I think it's important that this becomes part of their repertoire, or some, you know, whatever works for them to keep them a little bit regulated and grounded.
And then moving on to, you know, just behavioral issues in general, what is normal behavior versus not normal? And as a parent, when should we be seeking help?
Yeah. So I work with a lot of parents. I do a lot of parent coaching with the kids that we support, but also I do some parent coaching with kids that I'm not supporting, right? And kids' behavior, it's hard, isn't it? I mean, I've got three little kids at home and I fully understand behavior, and it's still hard for me. It's frustrating. It feels chaotic. So what I try to help parents with is what is kind of typical behavior and what is not. And when it's typical behavior, it's not the child that we need to do anything with. It's ourselves, right? Mm. Because the kids are being kids. This is what they do. Kids are made to play. And when you ask them to do something other than play, you're probably going to be met with a bit of resistance, because that is a child's main role, to play, right? That's what they were born to do. They just play. I work with a lot of kids with autism and I coach their parents, right? And a lot of things related to autism are not what you would expect for that age, but a lot of things are, right? So if they're doing something or not doing something, a lot of times I have to coach parents with, I think even if they didn't have the diagnosis, they would still be doing this. So we don't have to analyze and put everything under a microscope. Let's give it a couple of weeks. Let's give it a month. Let's give it 2 months. And if we don't see that it's starting to kind of get a little bit better or start to improve, then we can target it to improve, right? Even with like feeding. So I work with a lot of kids with feeding difficulties, picky eating, texture sensitivities, but feeding difficulties is very normal, right? Something that happens around the age of three and they stop eating things that they used to eat. But typically, if you're pretty patient, you still present vegetables, you still present fruits, you're not overly pushy, you're experimenting with different foods. Typically, you see after about 6 months, okay, they start to kind of eat a little bit more. They just went through a little leap. They went through a little stage. But when you see kids not to kind of come back to that state after kind of 6 months or 3 months, then you know that, okay, maybe we need to intervene and maybe we need to provide them a little bit of extra support. Language comes up a lot, right? So most of the time when parents come to me with very young children, it is because their child is not communicating and doesn't have language. That's usually the big flag, because that's what you're told by your pediatrician. They should start having words. They should start talking and communicating. And then when you don't see that, usually you seek that help, right? So, you know, it's hard to say. It really is. I mean, I see a lot of kids who are kind of 18 months, 2 years, 2.5 years, right? And when those kids aren't talking, only babbling, maybe they're just a little bit delayed. And maybe by the age of four, they're going to be speaking in full sentences, even without support, right? But when I see a child, I can kind of tell when, if there's other things going on, so not responding to their name or their play skills are not kind of what they should be. They're not really participating in things if they're in a structured, you know, nursery setting. Maybe it's a little bit more than just a simple delay. So it's, you know, I try to guide parents with what to put under a microscope and what to not put under a microscope.
Yeah. And I mean, at the moment, my son he's 3.5. He can very much communicate. He talks all the time, but school have picked up this certain words he can't pronounce, certain phonics, and they've actually said they think that ties to sometimes his attention span is lower because it all links together. And it's really hard when they're at this age to know, is it just a speech delay or is it something else underlying? So when should people seek help and where should they start? Do you go to the doctors? Do you contact us? Where do they begin?
Yeah, so there's all different routes. Some people go to their pediatrician, right? I would say a developmental pediatrician would probably be the best to go to, because obviously they're specialized in development and they could do different assessments. Some go straight to like a child psychologist if they want an assessment, right? And then those people would either say, I think we need to do an assessment, or they might say, your child's too young for an assessment, or I don't really see anything, but if you're worried, do this, do that. Sometimes they would say straight away, we're not going to do an assessment, but I think you should do speech therapy, occupational therapy, behavioral therapy. I mean, those are usually the three kind of areas, right? So pediatricians and psychologists would, you know, tell you straight away what to do and where to go. I get some parents that come to me straight away, right? So they don't go down a pediatrician or a psychologist route. They just want to get the help, right? So they don't really want somebody to tell them where to go. They talk to other people and they just know their child needs support. And I do think when kind of looking at what is kind of typical for your child or not, sometimes it's confusing and I had to help parents, but sometimes parents know better than me because there's something about your intuition, right? I work with a lot of small kids. I do my functional assessments and I see the child, but it doesn't really matter what I say because the parents say, you're going to work with my child. I know something isn't right. So no matter what you say.
Power of intuition.
Yes, right. I mean, they just know. And I will, a lot of times, you know, if a school flags something, it's really difficult because even myself as a parent, sometimes you think, no, they're fine. I don't know what you're talking about. It's just because they're young. It's just because they're little. The schools see it from a very different perspective and it's in a group setting. So they can see other kids' behavior and they're, you know, they are comparing, right? Yeah. And I do think it's important that we listen to the schools, even if I'll admit it with my own son, I did fight it, not actually fight with the school, but I fought it within myself. It was kind of flagged different things with him when he was in nursery. And I thought, oh no, he's just little. He'll grow out of it. He'll be fine. And he's still having difficulties, you know, but I, you know, he got speech therapy, he got occupational therapy, and now some of my therapists are doing behavioral therapy with him. I don't think that a parent should just take whatever a school says and just does it. But I think that they should take those concerns and really think about it. As much, you know, parents need to get educated, go to psychologists, go to pediatricians, talk to the school. But over time, I really feel that parents need to become the all-knower of their child. So over time, they need to educate themselves so much that they know exactly what their child needs. So they can almost guide the professionals or kind of help the professionals a little bit, especially in a place like where we live. It's so transient. People come and go, you know, but parents are the permanent fixtures in a child's life. So I think that's really, really important.
Before we start to wrap this up, I just wanted to ask if we had a child with a possible ADHD diagnosis and we ignored it, we just kind of were like, oh, it's fine, dug our head in the sand. Is that going to snowball into something bigger, or is it something that will just kind of stay the same and will be what it is?
I mean, all kids are different, right? So their needs and their challenges are very individualized. So one child might kind of get by, but just barely, right? Or they might kind of get by, but have kind of internal anxiety issues and struggle a lot more than we actually kind of see.
Yeah.
Other kids you would see, and it would snowball. It would snowball academically, right? You would see that as they progress through the grades and as the academics get harder, they fall further and further behind and things are more difficult for them. And then maybe you'll see behavioral difficulties because it's so hard for them and they don't have the skills to deal with it. It turns into a lot of escape behaviors and a lot of kind of non-compliant behaviors at school, right? And things can kind of snowball at home as well. So it depends on kind of the intensity and the severity of a child's ADHD symptoms, because every child is very, very, very different. I mean, I see kids who, you know, struggle and they have outbursts at school. You know, they have physical outbursts where they drop to the floor and kick and scream. Even though, you know, they've got tons of friends, their language is amazing. They can say all the things, But then this is kind of their response to something that's just too hard and no one's really properly helping them.
Yeah.
Whereas some kids, I feel, internalize it a little bit more and, you know, have other more subtle ways of getting out of things. So I think it depends, but I think for kids,
yeah,
it would culminate into kind of some pretty bad difficulties. But you hear a lot from adults, like I've said, who have been diagnosed, and obviously they're probably, you know, successful adults, but when they look back on it, they think how much they suffered.
Yeah.
And it's not necessary.
No. My final question for you before we move on to tips and products. We touched upon autism and you mentioned that it's something that you specialize in. Can you just tell us a little bit about what autism is and how it's linked to behavioral issues?
So autism is a diagnosis, right? It would have to be diagnosed by developmental pediatrician, child psychologist, using the ADOS, the ADIR, things like that. It is a behavioral diagnosis. So it's usually characterized by rigid kind of stereotypical behaviors, either kind of routine wise or motor movements that are a little bit stereotypical, social skills deficits, right? So lack of play or rigid play or not playing properly. And there's always a language component, always a language and communication, right? So no language or repeating other people's phrases over and over again. So they have language, but it's not functional. Or if they do have language, it can be kind of rigid as far as conversational topics and things like that. You would notice it, you know, when a child is young, because there would be milestones that are missing. I mean, with that, there are some kids who mask it quite well. So it kind of goes unnoticed for quite a long time. Particularly girls are very good at this. So I do know of some older girls that have gotten diagnosed kind of later in life because they masked it so well. So it is truly, it's autism spectrum disorder. It is truly a spectrum. Truly, wow. Truly. So all kids are very, very, very different. And the main reason, you know, you see behavioral outbursts sometimes that are not quite typical for their age. So, you know, if I'm working with a three-year-old, of course, three-year-olds have meltdowns, right? All three-year-olds have meltdowns from time to time. Some, you might go through a little leap where it is actually pretty severe and it's daily. But a lot of times, you know, children with a diagnosis of autism, these behavioral problems, these behavioral outbursts are more intense, longer, they go on for months and months, you know, they don't seem to be getting better, going away on their own. A lot of times, most of the time, it's due to a communication problem. So they're not able to communicate their needs, which so they present their needs through challenging behaviors, right? So it's just a matter of kind of figuring out what are they seeking through these behaviors. You know, so what is the root need? And then trying to teach them other ways to get those needs met, right? And a lot of time, and most of the time, it's through communication.
Yeah, which is key. Yeah, very important. Oh, thank you so much. I feel like I've learned so much today. We always ask our guests to leave us with one tip and one product. So if you were going to leave us with two nuggets, what would they be?
I think with kind of behavior change, I think it's really, really important that we think about giving our kids and giving ourselves as many opportunities as possible, but we always want to keep with our authenticity and our child's authenticity, right? So we want to give our kids all of the skills, all of the social skills in the world, but then at a certain point, we along the way, we need to really listen to them, even if they're not saying it to us, about what they really, really, really need. And it always needs to be very individualized. I think this world right now is just the world of, I've been kind of in the world of behavior change for a long time, but now everybody's talking about changing their habits and behavior change and this and that. But I think you really need to think about what works for you and what works for your child, not just what everybody says that we need to do.
Sure.
And as far as a product, I mean, I think there's so many different kind of products and things like that. I mean, I think if we're just, you know, thinking about things like ADHD, one of the classic things I will say, I know it's maybe not the most glamorous things, but writing is really hard for these kids. And I think teaching early on some alternatives for writing right? So my six-year-old, I'm teaching him to type like through an actual typing app so that maybe when he gets older, he's fluent with typing and he can do that instead of writing. But it has started pretty young, right? Really investing when they're little or when they're smaller so that as they get older, they have these supports in place. So I think different things with writing, so typing apps and things like that.
That's amazing. And Carrie, for anyone who wants to reach out and find you and ask any questions, where can they find you?
On Instagram, it's thrivingsouls_consulting. And my website is thrivingsouls.ae.
Oh, thank you so much, Carrie. And as always, everybody, please feel free to rate, review, subscribe. If you've enjoyed this episode, leave us a little comment. We'd love to hear from you. And you can find us on Instagram at We Are Mother Tongue. Carrie, thank you so much for your time today. You've honestly taught us so much about such an important topic. So I'll be forever grateful.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mother Tongue. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, please feel free to rate, review, subscribe and leave a comment. We always love to hear from you. Your support really means the world to us. And if you know any mums or mums-to-be who'd be interested in listening to our podcast, please feel free to share. You can also find us on Instagram at We Are Mother Tongue. Until next time, mamas.